Hello everybody and welcome back in time to the Shark Tank for another edition of the podcast. We appreciate we've had a little bit of a break since our kind of season kickoff a few weeks ago with Fergus and Tristan and Connor Doherty. But we're back with a slate of Premiership Rugby Cup games to discuss, a new format in the Premiership Rugby Cup to also kind of make sense of as well. And obviously the elephant in the room or in the recording studio is the World Cup is on, and we're going to have a little bit of chat about that as well. So my name is Lewis, and joining me are my co-hosts Alex and James. Alex, how are you?
I'm very good, thanks, mate. Enjoying the Rugby World Cup and enjoying the general amount of sport on at the moment. It's there's been a few weekends where you're having to watch about three screens at once when things like the Ryder Cup and the Rugby World Cup and normal rugby's going on at the same time. So yeah, that's been superb. I think very excited to get into the proper season. Nothing against the Prem Rugby Cup, but it's very hard if you're not at the game to get any sense of what went on, because I think I was all expecting a full match replay on week one, and when that didn't turn up, I quickly realised that this was going to be highlights at best, or in the case of the Calder game, you're just going to have to rely on a Twitter match report. So yeah, very excited to get back into the full Prem season with the Rugby World Cup finishing up, getting into the knockout stages, and yeah, just feeling quite positive about everything Sale related, despite, you know, a few, let's call them warm-up hiccups against in this competition. But I think we've managed the team well, and we're looking like we're going into Northampton next week firing based on the last result of the Premier Rugby Cup. How are you?
Yeah, very well. I think you've hit the nail on the head, which will also, I think, guide some of our chat around the PRC, which is it's very difficult to get hold of what's happening in those games if you're not at the game. And we'll talk about kind of our initial thoughts on this competition, this new look competition, in a moment in more detail. But James, how about yourself? How are things on your side?
Yeah, good. I mean, we had that awesome pod talking about the academy and previewing the Premiership Rugby Cup. And I think it's now, you know, without, you know, just, I mean, only seeing highlights really, you know, but even so, just looking at the results as a whole, you know, reflecting on that conversation, having a look at the teams that were picked for those games and how the squad has been rotated and changed a little bit now going into the first game of the season. It's really interesting to see, especially what Fergus was saying around getting the squad primed, giving youngsters the opportunity, especially in the earlier games, and then making sure that the kind of first team is ready to go on that first game of the season. And that's definitely how the selections have played out. I'm sure that they would have preferred to have won every game. But we can discuss that.
Yeah, so let's do the primer on this competition for those of you who've not been following along, and we, you know, with the Rugby World Cup on at the moment and the slightly rotational nature of this competition. I don't think anyone could blame you for maybe not being completely au fait with what's happened. So we'll do a quick recap. Obviously, five games have been played as part of what is unfortunately looks more like a pre-season competition at times. Sale are out of the competition. They finished second in Pool B behind Leicester. Sale won three out of their five games. I'll run those down very quickly for everyone's benefit. 47-12 over Bedford in the opening game, an 18-14 loss to Leicester in the second game, a 23-10 loss to Newcastle in the third game, which effectively knocked them out of the competition. And then they followed that up with back-to-back wins, 24-7 away at Caldy, and 64-0 over Ampthill on Friday night. So ultimately, Sale out of the competition. But to James's point, already that was been made already. The manner in which Sale and quite a lot of teams have approached this competition, giving a lot of their academy players opportunities here, has kind of shown that it's probably a case of job done for Sale. They've got some minutes into some of their first team players. They've had a longer look at some of their academy or players on the periphery of the squad, and whilst they haven't necessarily progressed through to the semi-finals of the competition, yeah, they have still won three games and racked up a positive 104 points difference. So I guess, Alex, I'll go to you first. You know, your thoughts on the competition. I mean, Sale have kind of, you know, it's not a success by any stretch, but I guess it depends on how you're measuring success, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a really good point. And I think we obviously would have expected to beat all the three championship teams, which we did, and relatively comfortably in all cases. I mean, going away to Caldy, no kind of mean feat from what I've... And this is, if you weren't at Caldy, then we're all in a bit of guesswork. But from what I've heard, Caldy tackled like the lives depended on it. Really, you know, just chopped and chopped and chopped. But Devon really offered a massive amount in attack. So we did quite well to come away from there with a bonus point, I think. In that scenario, obviously, it doesn't really matter in the context of the competition. But kind of a good mental test to go somewhere like that. I mean, you know, anyone who's played junior rugby around the Northwest will know very well that Caldy is a horrible place to go on your Saturday or Sunday morning. I think the Leicester and Newcastle games are the more interesting ones. The Leicester one, I think they put out a slightly more senior team than we had, which did make a bit of a difference. We were obviously very close. We last play of the game, we still had the ball and kind of dropped it and made the mistake that the end of the game. So it was still in our hands at that point. You know, like I say, I think Leicester were using this competition with a new coach coming in to kind of test their combinations ahead of the Prem. We're in a slightly different place. We know what combinations work. We know that, you know, Gus Waugh and Robert Breer work together. We know that Rafi Quirk works, et cetera, et cetera. So we didn't really need to put out such a senior team, which I think in the long run will benefit us. But obviously in that game, kind of, you know, you do see the impact of them having their Premiership starters on the pitch. And then Newcastle, I think, is just a bit of a horror show, really. It's always a horrible place to go. It was a Friday night. It was cold after having had some lovely weather over the first couple of rounds. And that's just, you know, we shouldn't be losing by that many points to that Newcastle team, I think, because we put out a stronger team for that as well. So that's the really disappointing one. And like you say, that's the one that knocked us out. I think that you win the Leicester game and there's probably a bit more focus on that Newcastle game, whereas because it's sort of, well, we've lost to both the Prem teams and we've beaten Championship teams, the whole competition kind of fades into exactly what it started as, which is, oh, this is a nice little warm-up. You know, some people have got a hit out. But actually, kind of in those games, you look at the Leicester one and you know, you're 5 points away, you're a try away from winning it. And the Newcastle one, I think, is a real sort of... It's good to have that result in the Premier Rugby Cup. That's the only positive I can take out of that whole game, because we were poor. We didn't really turn up until right towards the end of the game. And hopefully that's the kind of kicker that the squad needs for the next time we go up to Newcastle in April or whenever it is next year, that, you know, they're a very, very good team at home. And we know that because we constantly struggle to beat them at home. Yeah, that's kind of my take on the overall competition. I think there's definitely some positives come out of it in terms of individual players. There's definitely the positive of, I think, the way we built the squad in each game to the point where you look at that squad in the final game against Ampthill and you think that could start against Northampton. And we've kind of introduced those players gradually. It's really good. We've obviously had players like Jonathan Priya coming back from a World Cup training camp, which is, you know, a bit of an integration point that takes some time. So it's good to have done that in this competition. And overall, it feels like, you know, it's not, oh, amazing. We're not in a semi-final, so it's obviously not amazing. We're going to have 2 weeks off in February or whenever this competition finishes that we're just going to be sat around recovering. But I think there's those positive storylines. My favourite bit of the entire competition, which I was shocked when I started seeing the notifications come through on Friday night, is finding out that Gus Waugh can kick sticks. Who knew? Absolutely nailing it. So all credit to Gus. I mean, I thought this pod knew everything about Gus Waugh, but I certainly didn't know that. So yeah, that was a particular highlight. And then I think we should also talk about Nye Thomas's try, Because if you two haven't, I presume you two have seen it.
Yep, yep. Just outrageous stuff. And I do have notes from each game, but I'll be completely transparent with the listeners. I think there's usually two or three against each game. So there ultimately isn't a lot to talk about in these games. We lose to Leicester, but Leicester have, you know, Andre Pollard coming off the bench at 50 minutes and, you know, Josh Bassett and Ollie Hassel-Collins as the starting wingers. There's a real kind of, you know, compare and contrast with some of these teams. And it's the same with that Ant Hill game, right? Which is, you know, 64-0, yeah, great job done. But you actually look at the Sale team and you have like Johnny Hill, Jean-Luc Dupria. You know, these are tier one international players, you know, rolling out against a team like Ant Hill who, you know, no disrespect to them, but they are not even at the top end of the championship sort of spectrum. And so, you know, it's quite clear that a cricket score like that is to be expected. But I'm glad you mentioned Gus Waugh, Alex, because just there were a couple of things across all the games that I did want to point out as being quite interesting. And Gus Waugh kicking conversions versus in that final game was particularly notable. Same with Tom Curtis, who kicked about 85% for the first three games. It's always interesting to see who steps up for goal kicking duties when possible. And also, I don't know if you spotted this, but Tom O'Flaherty was getting some game time at fullback as well, which I found quite noticeable. It's particularly noticeable because he had a bit of a horror show against Adam Radwan, who runs around him. But again, we talk a lot about the Sale team and kind of what can we learn from these sort of games. And, you know, I think we've mentioned a few times fullback is still a bit of a question mark. We don't know what's happening with Luke James in terms of what position he's sort of seen as by the coaching staff. We've obviously got Joe Carpenter who's come through, but you want a little bit more depth in that position. So I thought it was just really interesting to see O'Flaherty get a bit of time at 15 when Tolosa Viani wasn't on the field. So yeah, just a couple of interesting things to call out there. And James, I guess from your perspective, you know, what's your take on Sale's first 5 weeks of the season overall?
Yeah, I mean, I thought Alex gave a pretty good overview, but I think we actually, to take the first two games, which is a similar squad that turned out for both of those first two games, right? Interesting that Tom Curtis was captain as well for those games. So really trying to say, okay, you're the 10 for these games and you're the general, you're in charge. You know, there was more senior, more experienced people in the team, but they chose to go with Tom Curtis, which I thought was really interesting. I was quite excited about. Because, you know, it's like, is this year going to be the year where, you know, he's the backup to George Ford, actually. And you've got Rob Dupria sort of in the bucket with Bedlow and Sam James for that kind of playmaking centre role. What I was disappointed about was that, you know, after a few games, he was rotated out, which is totally understandable. We need to give other people game time at 10. But the fact that it was Rob Dupria slotting in at 10, now that might be, you know, just an obvious thing where he was brilliant there last year and George Ford's away at the World Cup, right? And you need to get off to a good start in the Premiership. Fair enough. But like, at what point, right, does Tom Curtis get a go? And the reason why I'm asking this question is because we've just seen Kieran Wilkerson go to Leicester. So, you know, another young, you know, talented fly half that we've had. We've also got Bedlow and Sam James, who we know can play, have played quite a bit at 10 at Premiership level. So what it means is if Tom Curtis isn't starting at 10, he doesn't get into the 23. And if you're not in the 23, you're not playing any rugby. So that's my one concern, I suppose, going into this year, is, you know, sort of how that sort of has transpired is, you know, what happens with Tom Curtis? How does he actually get the opportunity to push on? Because the Kieran Wilkerson Achilles heel was kicking a goal. Tom Curtis is always a brilliant goal kicker at age group, but whether it was the pressure of or just the lack of continuity or something playing for Sale Sharks, his goal kicking wasn't quite up to standard either. Whereas that 85% that you've just got there is super interesting, because that's probably, you know, what he was seen as a potential goal kicker in the age group. So that there's some good and some just, you know, let's see what happens on that regard. We saw Luke James, I think, at the beginning of those set of games and pretty much not seen again. So again, you know, we didn't see much of Luke James in the second half of last season. Joe Carpenter nailing down the first choice 15 slot. Luke James, I think, played in the center here. You know, I see him, you know, as a could play 12, 13 or 15, but he's somebody who gets better the more games he plays and is somebody really, I think, to build a team around. He's that kind of player, that kind of level of consistency that you can really base a team around. Doesn't look like the coaching group see him in the way that I do. And therefore, I think it's a bit of a waste of somebody who's got well over 100 games for sale and still only about 23, 24 years of age. So I'm worried about a potential waste there. I thought the Newcastle game was the biggest negative because we sent up a really, really strong side that on paper should have won, like no doubt about it. And it sounds like we just had a horror show, as Alex said. And actually, you know, it got battered. Now, these things happen at Kingston Park. You know, we've been on the receiving end of that a few times, so you shrug your shoulders. The real upside was that Leicester game, you know, where the Leicester side, as you said, Pollard coming off the bench, it was an experienced side. The sales side, it did have, you know, sort of dotted experienced people around. But basically, it was not our first choice side. And to nearly win that game was extremely promising. The Caldy game sounds like it was, you know, played in difficult conditions. So you can always make allowances for that. I think that the way that we sort of cantered through the Amptill game, yes, they're in the bottom third of the championship. But I think it's a mindset thing to go into that game against Northampton at home with the confidence that the attacking game and attacking structures, you played through them, you know, first, second, third phase attacking structures. I think that'll help you then when you're in a pressured game like against Northampton and, you know, starting the season with a home game, we all know you've got to win that. You've got to set the tone for it. And it's potentially, you know, that you know, a bit like, I suppose, what the England coaches are trying to say about England in the World Cup, that, you know, sort of played with heavy legs in those World Cup warm-ups and actually more now in, you know, and there's question marks over their fitness. Now they're sort of in peak fitness condition at the World Cup. And I hope that it's the same for Sale here, that, you know, we're going to go in super fit, super ready for that game against Northampton. And, you know, the luxury of having this many pre-season games, I know it's a cup competition, we should talk about whether, you know, the fact that it's lumped on the beginning of the season during the World Cup has kind of devalued a really good opportunity here. And then with Jersey's news really sort of, you know, sort of stopping it in its tracks, really. But, you know, for Sale Sharks to sort of rotate the squad, give people an opportunity, try out some new things, some people in some new positions, you know, we've got a good chance of, I think, of hitting the ground running against Northampton. We're a big game team, I think. And I think that I reckon we're going to turn up with that mentality on Sunday.
Well, you've alluded to something that I think it's quite important that we do discuss, which is, you know, kind of what's been our general thoughts about this competition so far? Because I remember 5, 6, 7 weeks ago, we were talking with a lot of excitement about this competition. You know, a sort of rugby's version of the FA Cup, you know, some, you know, pretty tasty looking fixtures on there. And I think, you know, for the most part, when you look at the results on paper, it's kind of been as you'd expected or what you would have hoped. You know, the Premiership team's obviously doing some major bits of business against particularly some of the weaker Championship teams. But then, you know, Ealing are one of the four teams to get through to the semi-finals, which is obviously, you know, a real show for a non-Premiership team to get through to the latter stages. You know, we've seen Coventry beat Saracens. There's, you know, there's been a couple of upsets in there. And, you know, I think when you take a step back and consider, okay, maybe there's 15-20% of games are being won by a Championship team versus a Premiership team, it's pretty good. You know, it's kind of what you'd hope for. The problems are twofold. From my perspective, I'm interested to see if you guys agree, and you've kind of spoken about them already, so I assume so. Number one is this is on during the World Cup, and obviously, out of necessity, the entire pool stage competition has been truncated to the beginning of the season, and the reality is people aren't necessarily going to be watching that closely because the World Cup's on, right? You know, for your casual rugby fan, do I want to watch Ireland, Scotland, or England, Samoa, you know, yesterday, or do I want to see Settle Amptill or whatever? It's a tough decision to make, and I think that's reflected in the sort of pretty average attendances we're seeing. The other thing is midway through the competition, Jersey Reds, who won the championship last year, go into administration. And I don't know, Alex, if you agree, but all the hopes that we had about this competition, I feel, were dampened quite significantly by the fact that the team that won the second tier competition last year can no longer afford to operate financially, just at the time where we are finally getting some greater collaboration and greater crossover between the first and second tiers of the English pyramid.
Yeah, it's just reflective of where English rugby is, isn't it? That you've got this, like you say, a really positive championship news story in Ealing winning their group and beating premiership teams and that kind of thing. And then that's offset with, like you say, the news about the best team in the championship not being able to survive and, you know, quite openly blaming the RFU and the English kind of rugby structure for that. And, you know, let's be honest, with Ealing, they've got a very wealthy financial backer who is willing to put money into them and lose it as of sale. You know, that neither are sustainable. The only difference between us and Ealing is we're in the Premiership and have been for a long time. And we've got a stadium that's, you know, meets Prem Rugby's ridiculous criteria, even though, you know, the attendance is, you know, sort of irrelevant thereafter. So, yeah, I think it's a real blow to kind of Prem Rugby in their attempts to get this competition more, you know, competitive and more exciting with the addition of the championship teams. And, you know, I don't think there's any fault from Prem Rugby here. This is their competition, you know, that they're trying to support the championship teams. The fault quite clearly lies with both the RFU cutting championship funding and, to an extent, the championship clubs who, you know, Jersey spent, the reason they won the championship is because they spent a lot of money, let's be honest. And yes, you can argue, probably rightly, that they deserve, therefore, to have some more funding and that kind of thing. But ultimately, if you're going to spend a lot of money on good players, and obviously you're getting a lot of good players to come to Jersey, which is, you know, ultimately quite far away, then you need to be able to fund that. And I don't know whether they kind of took the risk that winning the championship and that would give their investors a bit more confidence in the kind of view for the future. And that clearly hasn't happened. So it's a bit of a mess. It's a big mess. And English rugby is in a big mess. I think the way the RFU have been acting is not great at all. And, you know, it just comes back to the big question around this sport in England, that it's not run well currently. And for all the good things that I think Prem Rugby are doing, and we'll talk later about the introduction of things like a fantasy league, which is a really good initiative. You know, there's a lot of stuff that we've seen improvements from the Premiership Rugby organisation in the last few years, especially with Simon Massey-Taylor coming in. They are always going to be hamstrung by the fact that the game is governed in England by the RFU. And if the RFU aren't competent and good, then it's going to be an issue. And I think you've seen a slightly sort of niche parallel is in rugby league, where Super League spun out of the RFL and kind of tried to improve the game and tried to get teams on board. And ultimately, you had the RFL still being in charge of the game. And so that's the problem that English rugby faces. I think this competition has been really good. Let's be honest, it's the first year. So if you're expecting all the championship teams to all of a sudden, you know, give a few Prem teams a bloody nose, it just doesn't happen in rugby. It's too physical. You know, the gap is vast, and it's really easy to win a game if you're the more physical team, regardless of, you know, skill and intent and coaching and that kind of thing. So I think in a couple of seasons, if this carries on, we'll see improvements from those championship teams, and it will close the gap. it's really good to kind of give them that exposure. It's the same as at the World Cup with teams, you know, like Fiji and Georgia and Samoa and Tonga being able to play Tier 1 nations. So that's the positive out of it. But as you say, the question is, can these championship clubs survive for the next 2, 3, 4 years such that they're going to still be in the competition and able to give the Prem clubs a bloody nose in that time? Because, you know, they've released a statement in the last week kind of saying how insecure and kind of uncertain their position is. So, yeah, it's a very hard balance to kind of be really positive about the way the competition's gone. And I think genuinely it has been good. You know, Coventry beat Saracens, amazing. Like you say, Ealing winning is, there's some really good results in there, but it's all against the backdrop of the game is still in the issue, it's got all the issues that it had. And, you know, a few upsets don't cover that up, unfortunately, do they? So, people are paid a lot of money to find the solutions to these things. They have not yet found them, and without wishing to probably get myself or this podcast into trouble, I'm not going to say any more, but I think if people are paid lots and lots of money and decide to take lots and lots of money away from championship clubs and then championship clubs go under, then, you know, there probably needs to be a conversation about whether the right financial decisions are being made for the good of the game. But, you know, let's not go into that rabbit hole too much, because otherwise I think we'll all be in a very bad mood by the end of the podcast.
Well, one thing that might push us down that spiral just on Jersey is, you know, 2 weeks before they wound up, they beat Bath 34 points to 10 at the Rec, which is a fantastic result.
Yeah, I mean, anyone can beat Bath at the Rec, mate. They are rubbish.
And look, obviously, you can point to quality of competition and whatnot, but, you know, just at a time when the championship clubs and the domestic structure is getting, you know, some positive news stories, unless you're a Bath fan, things kind of go, well, things regress quite significantly, which is a real shame. James, before we move on to the World Cup and talk about a segue, that is, you know, it's as far as it gets from London Scottish versus Doncaster or whatever the result, whatever the games were over the weekend. Do you have any other thoughts on how the competition's gone? Anything else you want to flag? And any thoughts on Jersey?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about what's happened to Jersey is it could happen to pretty much any of the professional clubs in either of the tiers, maybe apart from a couple, Northampton, maybe Leicester, maybe Exeter. But, you know, if you have your one of your main investors or your sugar daddy step away from the club, then there is you are not sustainable and you go under. Yeah, the Wasps was a slightly different situation in that they had really financially convoluted it, the whole thing, moved cities, all sorts of stuff. But if you actually have a look at Worcester and you have a look at London Irish, that was the same sort of model of failure as Jersey Reds. Actually, Jersey Reds weren't the biggest spenders in the championship. Yeah, the Ealing miles more bigger spenders. I thought, you know, it was a shock to everybody, I think, when Jersey kind of went under there. I think it, when you have a look at the difference in funding between pre-COVID and now, it was unsustainable. Should the club have managed this better? You know, you should never run a business to the wall when there's livelihoods at stake in the way that they have. So there's some responsibility there. They should have been calling this out very transparently, especially since they won last year. They had an opportunity, I think, to actually really share the problem, you know, and do a lot of good for the championship, and they failed to do so. But, you know, for English rugby, we're at a critical juncture here, because, you know, if you're going to have 10 teams in the Premiership, you need a second tier professional second tier, and you can't be having all those clubs go under. Otherwise, and the gap does need to close when you've only got 10 clubs in the Premiership. Especially if you're ever going to get back promotion and relegation, you know, you're going to need two very tightly connected tiers with very closely linked. So watching clubs like Jersey Reds go to the wall, you know, at this stage, it just feels like just another kind of head in the sand moment for the English game. And, you know, we're a year since Worcester, Nothing has changed. It's just been left to drift and get worse. There is no vision. You know, you get the CEO coming out saying, we are on the precipice of a great opportunity. Like, I understand you want to inspire and motivate, but to do that, you've got to go and meet the game and the situation where it is. It's the same as any business leadership. Yeah, you've got to kind of face into the realities, be pragmatic and be honest with your employees, be honest with the investors, be honest, all of these kind of things. And I think that when the rhetoric that we've had from the CEO of the RFU in the last couple of weeks has been so adrift from the reality of the game, it just feeds into this. These guys don't know what they're doing. They're just having, you know, like nice meals and, you know, like down at Twickenham in their own little bubble. And they haven't got a clue what is going on. In terms of the competition, I think, you know, look, it's the one-off that it's alongside a World Cup. But for me, a couple of opportunities missed. You know, I've talked before about the need to make these festival games. It's the only way to differentiate it against big, big ticket matches. In the future, this will go against the Six Nations, so it'll be the same problem. So, you know, they need to call it Friday Night Lights or something, make it on Friday, so it's complementary to the international period games. And they need to move it into smaller stadiums. You aren't going to get people rocking up for 2,000 people at home in a big stadium. But get yourself down to Coldy for the game against Sale if the weather's all right. And that's a great experience because you can get into the clubhouse. There's a couple of marquees. You stand on the stand bank. You reminisce about the games you used to have there as a kid. And that's the way to reconnect to the grassroots. And so, you know, that's the kind of one idea. There has to be lots more. I think you have to hope that this is the start of making this into a better competition across both tiers during the international periods, and that it's complementary to the international game. So I'd say getting the competition out of the ground this year was an important first step, but there were still things missed that were obvious. Jersey going under during this competition just sings, I think, of the lack of medium to long-term vision a year since Worcester. I still have no faith that it's going to turn around, but I can still see some opportunity, and you've just got to hope that someone somewhere has the leadership required and the game can be honest with itself enough that they can move together as one. You know, we can't have individual clubs sticking their neck out going, you know, no, we don't want any relegation. We don't want this. No, enough of all of this selfishness now. You know, there's going to have to be a commitment from all of the stakeholders in the game. And there's going to have to be a commitment for a long period of time, 5-10 years. So they're going to have to show the vision and they're going to have to stick to it so that it gets the confidence of the fans, you know, of the money people in the game, you know, and so that there's a bit of continuity and consistency, because that's what the game is lacking now. And we're going to be going into this Premiership season with only 10 teams. So again, we're into a new, whole new sort of feeling. Now, there is opportunity within that, and I hope that we can take it. But again, we've kind of stumbled into this 10-team Premiership. There's still no contextualization from the leadership of how this fits in the long-term vision of the game now. It's just drifting. There's a plan on its way. Worcester went under a year ago. Like, what is going on? So, sorry. Another James rant to start the season, listeners. Lucky you. Strap yourselves in. You've got 9 more months of it.
To be fair, if I could get 9 more months of that kind of call to arms that went out a little bit earlier on, I think that's a good place, because you were right. There are, you know, systemic and structural issues with the game, and we've talked about it for 2, 3, 4 years now. And you do wonder just how many more teams is it going to take before we see radical change. Unfortunately, that's probably a conversation for another day. You could do an entire different podcast on that. We should shift our focus, though. We've done a little bit on the Premier Rugby Cup. Let's go to the other end of the spectrum now and talk about the the 2023 Rugby World Cup that's obviously ongoing currently in France. So again, just as a scene setter, we are recording this on Sunday morning UK time. So as it stands, we have six out of the eight quarterfinalists confirmed. So I'll just run these down for you. Wales, Ireland, New Zealand, England, France, and South Africa. There are, I think, three or four games left to be played in the pool stages later on today as we record this. So Tonga versus Romania, which won't have any outcome on the quarterfinalists. Fiji versus Portugal. Fiji need a single point against Portugal to qualify. Otherwise, Australia will get there ahead of them. And lastly, Japan versus Argentina, which is shaped up very nicely as one of the final games of the pool stages, which should decide who finishes as the runner-up of Pool C to go through alongside England. So, Alex, I guess we're kind of joining this competition basically midway through now. So we don't want to talk too much about individual games or whatever. But you know, have you got a summary of kind of how you found this World Cup? Because from my perspective, I'm still yet to see the real upset or the real kind of 2015 miracle in Brighton moment or anything to that extent, or Japan's run actually in 2019 as well. To me, it kind of feels like it's gone pretty much as we would have expected by now, bar maybe Fiji beating Australia.
Yeah, I think that is a fair point. I mean, I think the story of the World Cup for me has been Fiji because they should have beaten Wales. And obviously they were very close to doing so. Beating Australia is a massive result. I mean, I suppose the two big stories of the World Cup are Fiji and Australia, and you know, in one that has surpassed all expectations and one that has massively missed all expectations. So I think that is, I agree with you, there's not really been the shock. There's been a lot of competitive games. I think I've enjoyed watching teams like Portugal and Uruguay play a lot more than I've enjoyed watching, for example, Scotland, South Africa. Obviously, Scotland, South Africa, a very intense game first weekend, but not that interesting. Whereas, you know, you're watching Portugal and Uruguay play with the kind of ambition they play with, and some of the skill and quality on display has been amazing from those teams. And I think it's probably similar to, you know, this is the first World Cup with this kind of expanded number of teams. We've seen, you know, two teams from South America for the first time, that kind of thing. Not for the first time.
Three teams from South America with Chile as well.
Two teams from South America playing each other for the first time, wasn't it? With Argentina, Chile.
Chile, Argentina, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, I think the number of teams involved is really good. I think you're seeing that quality in the Tier 2 nations that we really, again, World Rugby, in the same way that English Rugby needs to promote the Championship, World Rugby needs to promote those teams. So I have enjoyed that. I think the kind of flaws in the draw that we all know about with Scotland, Ireland, South Africa being in one group have sort of come to the fore in Scotland getting knocked out yesterday, which is a bit of a shame for them. I think they weren't great against either South Africa or Ireland. Had they been in England's group, they probably would have got through. So it's a bit of it's a really tough one for them. But also, it's made some amazing games. I mean, the Ireland-South Africa game was just brutal intensity. It's going to make winning the World Cup from that side of the draw very, very difficult, I think. I still think we'll get the winner from that side of the draw because I've not seen anything in England's side of the draw, to inspire me. But it's set up really nicely. I mean, an Ireland-New Zealand quarterfinal and a France, is it France, South Africa?
France, South Africa. Those are the two confirmed at the moment.
Wow. The problem the competition has is that it is peaking at the quarterfinal stage because, and I mean, the semi-finals are probably not going to be quite as inspiring because it's going to be whoever's come out of, you never know if, you know, there's a real opportunity here for Wales and England to get to a World Cup final. If Wales want an opportunity, it's such a shame because you think if Wales had the team they had 10 years ago, they could genuinely be in a shout of winning the World Cup with the way the draw's gone, because you know that they could just get a one-off result, especially with Gats back. But yeah, so I think that draw's kind of created some massive intrigue, but also a bit of lopsidedness. So yeah, I've really enjoyed the tier two teams. I've been really disappointed by Italy. It's been woeful. And I think the problem with that is it's sort of given people some ammo for this discussion of, oh, well, this is the problem with the Rugby World Cup. You see these big score lines. That's not the problem, because Italy have beaten Wales in the last year. You know, they're a very, very good team who've had an absolute shocker. I don't know what's gone on. Kieran Crowley's maybe given up, given he's leaving at the end of the World Cup. But things like that aren't a great look for the game, and it's hard having to sit there and explain it. I mean, I saw someone say, oh, New Zealand, Italy, I can't believe this. This is the problem with rugby. This is why the Rugby World Cup will never, you know, be a serious competition, because New Zealand had beat Italy by however many points. I mean, I watched the Football World Cup when Brazil lost 7-1 in a semi-final at home, so I don't think teams getting battered in a World Cup is necessarily indicative of a massive flaw in the sport, but it does mean you have to sort of be explaining that kind of thing. So, yeah, it's been a really interesting one. I've genuinely really enjoyed it. I think the length of the World Cup with the big week gap in between is difficult for people to get into, but I think if you're into it, it's really good, because you can watch every game and it's like, you know, it's maintainable. So as a rugby fan, I pretty much watched every game this World Cup, and it's been brilliant. You know, if it was on in the day on a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, it'd be harder to do that, wouldn't it? So that's one positive for me. And I think, yeah, like I say, it's really well set up for some amazing quarterfinals. And then, you know, I suppose the semi-final and the final are big occasions anyway, so it should work. But I think it's really hard to call who's going to win it still, isn't it? I think we'll know after the quarterfinals that we've got a favourite. And it'll be coming out of that side of the France, South Africa, Ireland, New Zealand draw. You know, it'll probably be two of those four. I think if I'm right with the way it works, two of those four can meet in the final, can they?
Yeah, so I've got the bracket up at the moment. This is from Wikipedia, so it's actually, you know, usually pretty good. So as it stands, you have Wales versus the runner-up of Pool D, which is most likely to be
Argentina, I think. Well, it's 50-50, isn't it?
Yeah. So Japan have actually hit four from being horrific for a couple of years. They've hit some form in this World Cup, whereas Argentina have gone completely the way, beat the All Blacks, beat South Africa, beat Australia, and then rocked up and put in probably the worst performance of the World Cup, apart from the Italy game against New Zealand, I'd say. Argentina in that game against England it was embarrassing.
I'm going to ask you about that, James, because I know you've got Los Pumas. Because I know Los Pumas have a place in your heart. Anyway, the bracket is Wales versus, let's assume, Argentina, Ireland versus New Zealand, and then the winner of those two games will play each other in the semi-final. And then the other side of the bracket is England versus the runner-up of Pool C, which you would assume will be Fiji, versus the winner of France versus South Africa. So there is a possibility that France, New Zealand, South Africa, Ireland could meet in the final, which is what it kind of looks like at the moment. I think you made a good point though, Alex, just on the pool format. I'm gonna throw a controversial opinion out here before I get James's take on the tournament. I've actually quite enjoyed the pool format. Yes, there's been a couple of cricket scores. You know, yes, you know, some of the groups look a bit weak versus others, but actually, you look at the teams that are progressing out of it, and in every pool, it's been a case of, if you can beat the two other top three teams in your pool, you're through. And what's actually happened is, I think in every single pool, assuming Fiji go through, the correct two teams have gone through. So you look at the pool B with Ireland, South Africa, and Scotland, right? Scotland, you know, got knocked out last night. Well, they lost against Ireland and South Africa, so they don't deserve to go through. Australia lost against Wales and Fiji, so they don't deserve to go through. Italy, you know, they absolutely pumped Romania, but then they got pumped themselves by New Zealand and France, so they don't go through. I think it actually does work pretty well. And James, one thing I want to get your thoughts on is, I think outside of Romania, I don't think there's necessarily been a bad showing from a team in this year's tournament. Namibia, you can maybe lump into that group as well. But I think overall, Uruguay, I think have shown up pretty well and obviously got a win. Chile haven't won any games, but have looked pretty good and have played some enterprising rugby. Same with Portugal. I think overall, the competition has had 17, 18 pretty good teams in it. And I think we've had a pretty good pool stage overall.
Yeah, and you know, Namibia is an interesting one because, I mean, African rugby does have a problem. You know, Namibia, you know, Madagascar side, you know, they just walk getting through and they have an automatic qualifier. Versus, say, South America, who's the only continent who don't have an automatic qualifier for the Rugby World Cup. Obviously, Argentina automatic qualifies as a Tier 1 nation, but then so does South Africa in the African continent. So that there's a question there over from a political perspective for World Rugby, whether there's a bit of a redialing there. Growth of rugby in South America is a genuine positive. It's shown up really well again in this World Cup. Don't forget, the last World Cup, Uruguay beat Fiji. As well, and actually Namibia's best performance by a mile was against Uruguay in this World Cup. Uruguay did rotate their squad a little bit for that game, but you know, they maybe on another day Namibia could have sneaked it against Uruguay, but otherwise Namibia look a little bit out of their depth, you know, whereas the likes of Chile and Portugal, you know, come in as like the bottom ranked teams in the World Cup and has turned up to play real rugby that any fan can watch or even non-fan can watch and understand that they're trying to play rugby in the way it was designed to be played. And they've earned the respect of fans because of that, even though some of the score lines, especially the Chile-England game, etc., you know, hasn't always reflected it. But I mean, Uruguay had a great opportunity to beat France. You know, they scored that great try in the corner and then conceded straight off the kickoff. And that really sort of took the wind out of them. But you know, we've seen France lose those types of games before against Tonga in previous real cups, for example. So I think there are enough things there. The biggest example, of course, is Fiji beating Australia, and then Samoa should have beaten England last night. There's no question they should have won that game. And they did more to lose it than England win it, really, in the way that Samoa approached a lot of the second half. They'll be massively disappointed because a win would have shown up again the world rugby the way it's run, because you know, essentially the likes of Uruguay and Samoa, I mean, they're being written off forever. There's no point having an expanded World Cup with the approach that rugby is going to now go on for the next 4-year cycle. There's just no point. You're always going to, it's the fact, if anything, the gap will get bigger. There's no point Uruguay just playing the US and Canada forever. Then that they've already improved and now beaten those teams. That's been the journey over the last sort of 10 to 12 years for Uruguay. You know, they've gone from being, you know, qualifying for the odd World Cup and ever being the worst team in the World Cup. Now they're the best team in the whole of the American continent. They want to play. You know, play against Argentina, B team, and play against USA. So I think that for me is the biggest question mark, is when Samoa come within a point of winning, beating England, and then aren't definitely won't be able to play England again now, unless they get drawn in the same group at a World Cup, potentially ever. Let's be honest, that's what's going to happen. So that's on what I'm a bit worried about. In terms of the World Cup itself, you know, big Wales not getting any shout outs at all. I think Mike Forshaw, he's gonna be given citizenship of that country very, very shortly.
We had to get a sale reference in there somewhere, because there just hasn't been a lot of sale interest. But yeah, you're right, Forshaw's been magnificent for Wales.
I mean, the Wales that you say that Fiji should have been Wales, but they should have done because they had the chance in the last play of the game. But let's not forget what happened for the first 60 minutes of that game, right? Fiji were rocking up off the back of beating England at Twickenham, and they came out with a level of physicality that I've only seen in that South Africa game against Ireland, right? And Wales stepped up defensively and physically. I mean, they're feeling it now, losing Faletau and a few others now to injury, because that was brutal. And Wales were extraordinary in defence for 65 minutes, and then actually were just knackered, I think, and you know, nearly lost in the final few minutes. But I think Wales have been absolutely brilliant. You know, let's not forget they've got like five good players and like 25 very poor players. And Gatland manages to just put them together and put them out on a pitch at a World Cup and make them competitive. I mean, it happens every single time. I think they've been phenomenal, even considering the Eddie Jones Australia meltdown, which has been something to... I mean, it was the seeds were sown with the World Cup selection for Australia, which, let's be honest, was strange. Even if you're planning for the next World Cup at home, it was strange. You could actually understand Foley and Cooper not being picked, but to pick an pretty much a sort of untried, untested 10 as the only 10 in the squad was just nuts. The pressure you were putting on that individual to perform at the highest level was just always going to be really, really difficult. So I found that side of the draw super, super interesting. You know, the fact that England could have lost to Samoa there, maybe even at one stage it looked like without a bonus point. If Argentina had beaten Samoa with a bonus point, they could have been on for winning the group today, potentially. So that for me brings a level of intrigue. I think it's the other half of the draw that has almost failed to deliver. I mean, Scotland sort of turned up against South Africa. They did. They didn't really turn up against Ireland yesterday. Italy is the third team in that group has been very poor, and actually, you know, laboured win against Uruguay as well. There, you know, to be honest, as well, Uruguay were in that game for most of it. I think they were leading at half time. Actually, Uruguay were beating Italy at half time in that game. So, I found that side of the draw a little bit boring, actually, aside from a great test match against South Africa and Ireland. You know, I was like, you know, actually, you can get that in an autumn international. There's not enough intrigue from other teams you don't normally see. That's why people are like, oh, Chile are quite great, yeah, or whatever, and you still get battered 71 against England. I think it's been, the format's okay. You know, I think I've struggled to get into it, but that's probably because of family needs. It's quite difficult for me to get the pass to maybe one game a weekend I'm getting to watch at the moment. So I caught the England-Samoa game yesterday. I thought Samoa were absolutely excellent. And if that try hadn't been disallowed, and that, by the way, if that was the other way around, highly controversial disallowing of that, because I don't think it was absolutely clear evidence of a knock-on. So to reverse an on-field decision that the TMO had already come in at and said it was fine, and the kick had actually already been completed. So I was like, wow, that really is you have to have 100% confidence of a reversal to reverse it in those scenarios. So look, I'm really pleased. I've got money on England making the semi-final. I put that bet on after they lost at home to Fiji. It's like 9-1. Put a tenner on there, so you know, quid's in for England. You know, I think they will beat Fiji in the quarterfinal and make the semis, which is absolutely remarkable. And then you only have to rock up for two games and you win the World Cup.
It is funny how this competition can work, and it brings me on to one thing I did want to ask you about, James, specifically, which is Argentina, who by my reckoning have been the most disappointing team in the competition so far, aside from maybe like a Romania where they just haven't really offered anything. Obviously, like you said, came in great form and then produced probably the worst performance of rugby I've seen in a long time in that first game against England, where they're a man up for pretty much the entire game and they lose by 17 points, 27 points to 10. They then labour to a win over Samoa. They then, you know, relatively comfortably beat Chile. Where do you stand on this? Because, you know, this is a team, to that point you just made about England, who, you know, if they've won a couple of games earlier on, if they've beaten England or whatever, they have a genuine chance of getting to a final as well. And they were a team that I was really excited about coming into the competition, because I thought you might see them get to a final this year. You know, beat... you beat England, top your pool, you know, quarter final against Fiji, for example. They had a really good chance. And to be honest, they've just really flattered to deceive so far.
Mm. Yeah, well, it just goes to show professional sport, you know, so much of it is mental resilience and momentum and confidence. We talk about this all of the time, right? Bath win, they won against Exeter at the weekend. They win their first two games of the season this year. Bath could be top four contenders in the Premiership. Right, that's how these things kind of work. The Argentinians rocked up to this. If they'd beaten England like they should have done, they could definitely have had some momentum. And Argentina are a confidence kind of team, have always have been. But, you know, that's why they're always quite inconsistent. Things, you know, a couple of calls go against them. They're being constantly spoken at in English. This kind of thing, they can lose their cool very easily, get red cards. That's always been the case. You know, they're not a team that they get pinged for offside in the first 5 minutes, readjust, and they're not no more penalties for the rest of the game. Pinged for offside in the first 5 minutes, they think it's they're hard done by. They'll just be offside every single ruck after that, and they'll lose field position, lose the game. The Pumas have always been the same at that. Equally, they can rock up, get some momentum, and they can, you know, beat an All Blacks. Done it twice now in you know, in the very recent past. So, you know, I think what happened against England was a professional team of players. Normally one or two players have a shocker in a game, or can have a shocker, but the other 13 players can still make it. That's the beauty of team sport, right? The game against England, all 23 players, maybe Guido Petty off the bench was the only exception, 22 players had their worst professional games in an Argentina shirt at the same time. And that is because it's like the Ryder Cup momentum on the final day, right? We ended up winning whatever it was, 16.5, 11.5, whatever it was. But like, actually, half an hour before we won it, it could have gone the other way. And do you know what? You only have to have missed out on one getting a half, and then the others could have folded. And that's kind of what happened for Argentina on the pitch against England. You know, they were in the game until the actual red card. They were playing a normal game of rugby. As soon as the red card happened, it was like it was the 72nd minute. And they were trying to score tries from their own 22, and they couldn't catch a ball. They knocked it on in every contact. They couldn't take a high ball. I mean, Malia, I don't know if you've seen him for Toulouse, doesn't drop a high ball ever. Never seen him drop one. Couldn't catch for absolute toffee against England, which is England's game, right? Kick, you know, Mitchell put it up in the air. Argentina knocked on, scrum England. The weakness of Argentina's game at the moment is the scrum. That's tended to be what happened. Their line out was completely dysfunctional, but there was no phase play possible. So they just allowed the pressure on back onto themselves, and then those drop goals from George Ford was just like a dagger in the heart. And they just the panic just it just took flight. And that, you know, the halftime was an opportunity to reset, and it didn't happen. So, you know, what's they've now taken that into those next games, and I think they did well to get through the Samoa game, to be honest, because I think, you know, they were so shot and shocked by the whole thing. You know, professional rugby is split second to make good decisions. If you're second guessing yourself, then, you know, all hell can be able to, you know, take place. So I think they go in second favorites against Japan today, who have had the complete opposite progression. They've come into the World Cup, it's been like muscle memory for them. They've kind of picked up where they left off in the last World Cup, just with a, you know, few more raging legs and some less good players, but essentially with the same approach to the game, the same way of playing. I think they are the favourites against Argentina today, you know, and it just goes to show how much confidence and mentality is part of this game. And I think it's good for people to see that, you know, you do need mentally resilient people to play international rugby, not just the best player, actually. It's actually who can make the best decisions under pressure, and Argentina haven't done that. That said, if they do get through against Japan, you know, then things can change for them. You know, a bit of luck against Wales, get into a semi-final, then suddenly you never know. So I wouldn't write them off completely. They've still got some very good players. He's made some very interesting selection calls. Sorry to bang on and make this an Argentina podcast again. But for example, you know, like no one would have expected Matias Orlando, Matias Moroni, and Geronimo de la Fuente, who's been their three first choice centres for two World Cup cycles, to basically be jettisoned at the last minute for a new partnership that haven't played together before, in Chucka Barros, who's a brilliant player, by the way, but had a shocker against England, and Lucio Cinti, who mainly played on the wing for London Irish last year. You know, again, a talented player, but these are very big calls in decision-making positions. He also made the same. He's played Gonzalez at eight. to decision-making position, never played eight in any of the age groups, never for London Irish. Meanwhile, he's moved, who has been playing number eight through the whole World Cup cycle, you know, to back to flanker in Matera. So it's all, so some really strange things, and that's what Sun stuck Eddie, both for England and for Australia, right? And you make these really strange decisions in decision-making positions, and you wonder why you lose.
It's very true. And the other point on this is, as I think you alluded to, they beat Japan today. They're into a quarterfinal with Wales. You could easily see them winning that. They're into a semi-final. And to be honest, that's a success for Argentina at this World Cup, isn't it? You know, to get to a semi-final.
Out of the last eight games against Wales or something. So yeah. You never know. But
I mean, that England-Argentina game was, I think, Argentina played very badly, but England massively forced them into that. And it was just a unique set of circumstances, wasn't it? You know, it was opening weekend of the World Cup. It was, the atmosphere was electric. The red card hyped England up to a level they've not been at before. And you can see that actually in that England team are still, as we saw against Samoa, they're still as bad as they were before the World Cup. They just had a really good game. Like you say, and Argentina had a really poor game. And that's the intrigue of the World Cup, that you're going into the quarterfinals. And you know that England could have an Argentina-style game against Fiji and then potentially against someone in a semi-final, and actually just pull us out of nowhere, out of those deep reserves of mental resilience, an amazing performance. But you also know that they could play that against Samoa and be out, you know, with a whimper. So it's a real... I think, like you say, that side of the draw, the England-Wales-Australia, that's been the... That's been all the intrigue and all the stories and all the kind of games you want to watch. And like you say, you know, Ireland South Africa was amazing, but I watched South Africa Scotland and I was uninspired. I didn't get to watch Ireland Scotland last night, but 10, 20 minutes in, I saw that, you know, Ireland were already running away with it. And you sort of like, well, am I going to turn this on to watch a game that happens every year anyway and seems to be now a foregone conclusion? And like you say, I think you now it's then interesting to see all those teams come together and you know, that cross across the draw, because the level of intensity has been so different. Because England's most intense game was that Argentina game. You know, the Samoa game was hard, but it wasn't intense. It wasn't test match level physicality like the Ireland South Africa one was. So that side of the draw has almost been not the easy ride, but, you know, people gradually building up. Whereas, you know, Ireland and South Africa and France and New Zealand are coming off a pool where they've either had an easy ride or it's been like basically a semi-final, final level of, you know, game.
Well, I mean, have a look at New Zealand, right? They had that big game against France first up, which they've lost. And since then, they've been able to manage their physicality really nicely. And so that I think, you know, New Zealand for me are the team. What about you, Lewis? Who's going to win?
Well, I was just about to ask you guys the same thing. So,
well, I'm asking you. Who do you think you're going to win?
I was just going to say it shows how long we've been doing this podcast together, because we know each other so well. You see, you know what? I'm not a betting man at all. If you ask me to put money on it right now, I would say South Africa. Very slightly ahead of France. I still think the French just look awesome. Damien Penaud is in you know, the form of his life. Pito Malvaca, let's not forget, the French hooker, was second choice up until about 3 weeks ago, and he's in the form of his life. You've got Melvin Jaminet, who kicks 92% or whatever it is. He can't even get a game because Thomas Ramos is kicking 93%. Like I said this before the World Cup, the depth that France have got just makes them impervious to anything. You look at them losing to Pony, it didn't make a iota a difference. That all being said, when the games get tight and it becomes knockout rugby, you look at just how good that South African team has been so far. And unfortunately, because I'd much prefer to see running rugby, you put your chips down on the team that's got the biggest, gnarliest and most well-oiled pack. And I think that is still South Africa. I'd probably like to see France win it because, again, they just tick all the boxes. They can beat you so many different ways. But I still think South Africa have a really good chance of winning it all. Even with the loss to Ireland, I think if that match happens again later on in the tournament, I think South Africa have their number. Where do you stand, Alex?
Yeah, I think Ireland got very excited about that South Africa game, but South Africa would not. That's not knockout rugby South Africa. That's pool stage South Africa, which are two very different beasts. I think France have got it. I think what's been really impressive actually this World Cup is the level of support France have got from the home crowd, because obviously you expect it at a World Cup, but the atmosphere has just been unbelievable. That Friday night, France being New Zealand, just ridiculous. And I think you've heard, you know, the Marseillaise at all the games, regardless of, you know, it'll be like Uruguay, Namibia or something. And, you know, they start singing the French national anthem. It's, so I think the atmosphere created has been really good. And I think for that reason, I think that might just carry France through, because I think quarterfinal, they're obviously South Africa in the quarterfinal. I suppose my answer is probably the winner of that quarterfinal wins it, but I do think that's going to be France. I think New Zealand are looking good, but I think Ireland have got the number. Again, that's going to be amazing either way. It's a bit weird because those four teams, whoever wins, goes into a relatively easy semi-final, sorry, before the final. So, yeah, I'm going France. And just on that point, I think as a World Cup, it's been brilliant. I think you can see when a country like France is so invested in rugby, they're able to put on a really, really good show. And I think, you know, the stadiums have been spectacular. I mean, I went to Marseille for the England-Argentina game, and honestly, that stadium is unbelievable. It's probably the best sporting stadium I've ever been in, and it was just one of the best atmospheres I've ever been in. And I think we should really appreciate that, because, you know, next World Cup over in the USA, is that the next one, or am I missing one out?
Australia 27, next US one. 31.
Yeah, and then the US in 31. So, yeah, I think it helps that it's so close to all the European nations and that kind of thing, but I just think the organisation, the atmosphere has been very, very good with a few teething issues at the start. But, yeah, I think what France have done as a team has kind of won them the support of the home crowd, and I think that'll carry them through. And I think it'd be really good to have a new winner of the World Cup and a Northern Hemisphere one. So I am rooting for France in the same way you are. But yeah, it is. It's all. I mean, we'll know in a week's time, won't we? Or a week and a day. You know, once the quarterfinals are done, this becomes a much easier conversation. But
well, that's how I'm going to answer mine. Right, I need to head off. I'm going to fudge the answer and say whoever wins that New Zealand against Ireland is going to win the World Cup.
I've got one more for you. I've got one more for you, and maybe this might lead in. One more question on the World Cup. Who has been your favourite player to watch so far? For a game with big spectacle, global spectacle, there's not enough like individual star power in rugby. Who's been your favourite player? And James, I'll go for you in case, you know, that your two answers are kind of linked together.
Well, I mean, Aki has had an amazing World Cup, hasn't he? He has been outrageous. It's a shame we didn't turn up like this for the Lions in South Africa. But there's been next level, I would say, in terms of improvement. I'd say the Fijian front row run him close, though.
That's I mean, all good answers. What about you, Alex?
A couple. The Uruguayan number six, whose name escapes me, has been ridiculously good, and we should sign him from a sale perspective. No, yeah, as every time I've watched them, his name's completely gone out of my head. But yeah, he is just, the way he plays is amazing. I loved watching the Georgian number seven yesterday. I'm not even going to try and pronounce the way he was bumping people off. That was class. I think from the big nations, probably Penno, as like you said, Lewis, has been just unbelievable to watch. Just what he does is ridiculous. I think Jaminet's Jalabert at 10 has massively stepped up for France. Like, he has played some amazing rugby. So yeah, that's a lot of people. Top of the list, degradingly can't remember his name, your grind number six. So South American rugby correspondent James Medley, if you can remember, please chip in, but otherwise I'll find it and tweet it. Yeah, go on, what about you, Lewis?
It's got to be Pio Malbaka. And not just because I went to New Caledonia for the first time quite recently. But obviously, for those of you who don't know, there's a couple of players in the French team who come from their overseas territory in the South Pacific. So Yoram Mofana as well comes from Wallace and Fortuna. I've got a bit of a soft spot because I'm like, I just love the fact that, you know, the French, unlike all the other countries in the world, the French pull all these players from around the world, but they are still actually French. But yeah, I just think Mavak has just been in unreal form. He was playing at number 16 for the last sort of 2-3 years as part of a World Cup cycle. And as all of a sudden, when the lights have shone bright, it's just pulled into some absolutely incredible form. And with that all said and done, go on, James.
Can I just say, just as a separate to this, biggest gnaws, Johnny Sexton and Dan Bigger in equal measure. I hate them both. An absolute pain in the arse on the pitch. I mean, it's great if you're Irish or Welsh, but as a neutral, oh my God, they are annoying. So, on the other end of the spectrum, worst players to watch.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Watching Dan Bigger shout at his teammates is a particularly bad look. Anyway, thanks so much to everyone for listening. We went a little bit over on the World Cup chat, but I mean, when you've got a tournament like this, it's really hard not to get excited about it. Thank you very much for everyone for listening. Thank you to everyone who continues to support us and follow us on Twitter. I know we've been a little bit quiet there at the moment, but that should ramp up a little bit more, particularly as the Premiership rugby action comes back. And then, James, I appreciate you've got to drop off. Is there anything from your side before I hand over to Alex for one final PSA?
No, nothing.
All right, mate. Well, you get yourself off. And then, Alex, I think you've got a fantasy league to tell everyone about.
I have indeed. And probably some other PSAs. But fantasy rugby is new this season. I did tweet about it, but I'm conscious not everyone has Twitter or X, depending on your opinion of Elon Musk, may also inform that. So if you get onto the Super Brew Fantasy League, which the Prem Rugby has put out everywhere, we have a Shark Tank League. The easiest way to find it is to go on our Twitter and look at the link I posted. But if you are on the league, we have a pool code. So if you enter this 8-character code, you'll automatically join the Shark Tank Fantasy League. The code is VERY, V-E-R-Y, ADDIT, A-D-I-T. So hopefully that was pronounced well enough, me with a little bit of a cold. There are 30 of us in it at the moment. So please do join us. I'm sure we'll be chatting about it week in, week out on the pod.
I need to do my team, so I'm really glad that you reminded me.
Yes, you've got 5 days, 10 hours and 52 minutes from 9:22 on Sunday morning to set your team. So I think it's before Friday night, first round of games. You've got a budget of, I think it's 100, whatever it is, so salary cap, sorry, appropriately. So yeah, get as many sale players in. I've sort of selected the starting team, but obviously you've got the advantage with rugby of seeing the starting teams a little bit further out than you do with something like fantasy football. So yeah, please do join that. There will be some sort of prizes. Who knows what they'll be yet, but we'll work that out as we go, depending on what we can get fined by Boris Steele. So yeah, that's the announcement of fantasy rugby. Please do join that. It'd be a good laugh. Other things that we should just mention, Sail Shark Supporters Club, please do join this season if you would like to. I think it's £12. You may have to correct me if I'm wrong there. But yeah, you can obviously join up, get access to all the events, get discounts off fun buses and things like that. So please do that, because that will be a great help to both the sports club and the club generally, and massively worth it for £12, if that's the right number. So please do that. And then in terms of other PSAs, I think that might be it. We're obviously back weekly with the Premiership coming back. So we've got the Northampton game, not really done a preview, but we will review that game in detail afterwards. Sale Sharks women haven't played any games yet, but they are coming back very soon. So keep an eye out for those. Get down to Hayward Road if you can. Sale FC have had an absolute shocking start to the season. So probably need your support more than ever if you can get down there whenever the games aren't on. And obviously, home game against Northampton for Sharks on Sunday the 15th. Be a really good one to get a big crowd down for. There's obviously the World Cup quarterfinals in the evening, so a good way to start your Sunday rugby. Massive game at home. Be really good to get a big crowd out. So, obviously I'm asking people to do a lot there, but I think join the Fantasy League because that's nice and easy and free and fun, and you could win some prizes, and then get yourself down to as much rugby as you possibly can. Very excited for the season to start. I think that's everything, Lewis. Tell me if I've missed anything, but no, otherwise,
I think you've done
a pleasure.
Yeah, you've done a very good public service there. So thank you very much to Alex. Thank you very much to James for joining us. Thank you to you guys for listening. And we'll be back with you next week to discuss Sale versus Northampton.